طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that it is broadcast every week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Today we grapple with the power of narrative. If one can control its nation's narrative, one can control how history is recorded and passed on to future generations. True narratives are based on facts. What actually happened? History books can and are written on a narrative that may or may not be true. Who do you believe? Does the teller of history base his narrative on facts that have been documented? Or is the narrative what the narrative teller wants to believe and wants you to believe? We talk about the Israeli narrative and the Palestinian narrative. They differ widely. Who is right? Go to the facts that are contained in a myriad of documents written at the time the events took place. Document that with historical sources. What really happened? That is the job of scholars, historians, authors, and documentarians. Not just one, but several. Applying these principles, one can evaluate narratives. Compare the documentation of the Palestinian narratives to the Israeli narratives, and then make your judgment. It is called research. The work of research is to get at the facts, and that is what should drive the narrative. These principles drive the narrative that you will hear today from our featured speaker, Thomas Suarez. Thomas Suarez is a London-based historical researcher, as well as a professional Juilliard-trained violinist and composer. A former West Bank resident, he devoted several years to researching poorly taped and newly declassified historical archives to compile his narratives. His previous books include three landmark works on the history of cartography and Writings on the Wall, Palestinian Oral Histories. His latest book is titled Palestine Hijacked: A Meticulously Researched History of the Development of Israel's Apartheid State from the River to the Sea. Here is Tom Suarez speaking before the Media Education Foundation in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Here, of course, to discuss Israel-Palestine, an injustice that has continued for more than a century now, with not so much as even a hint of the pretense of an attempt to end it by those with the power to do so. So the responsibility lies with us, the public. There are myriad ways to work toward that common goal, and I'd like to use this time to explain my particular approach in the hope that it might be of some value. I'd like to begin with a brief look at the issue's two most prevalent words in the public discourse. First, the word conflict, the defining noun of the issue. We need to ask, what does this conflict consist of? If we look at what is actually happening, what do we see? Well, we see aggression, the seizure of land by force, ethnic cleansing, the forcible expulsion of people due to their ethnicity, apartheid for those who remain, a system of suppression by ethnicity, erasure of the existence of the wrong ethnicity through the destruction or rebranding of their presence and the theft of their cultural iconography, whether through its erasure or its expropriation, and finally, the systematic dehumanization of the wrong ethnicity in order to justify the crimes against them. And crimes by one group against another is what this is all about. It is not a conflict between them, and that is not a matter of disagreement to be negotiated among equally empowered and legitimate interests. If we call it what it is, a crime, we demand it be stopped. We don't tell the unarmed victim to first recognize her heavily armed attacker and then tell her that she needs to sit down with him and work out their differences. If conflict is a word that stymies justice, occupation is the default word used by people fighting for justice in Palestine, the cure thus being to end the occupation. While this word is used with all good intent, in my view, it is a dangerous misunderstanding of the crime. If we ask, what is this occupation? Let's take the most inclusive definition normally used. Everything on the Palestinian side of the armistice line, the so-called 67 borders, that is to say, the West Bank, which includes East Jerusalem and Gaza and, of course, the Golan Heights. So, let's say the pro-Palestinian chants of end the occupation suddenly were answered. Israel pulled completely out of the land beyond the armistice line. Well, in my view, it would be a very sorry morning after, and we'd have forfeited the right to any further claim. We'd wake up to and be stuck with what? Well, a dissected remnant of what was once Palestine. The refugees still blocked from returning to their homes on the Israeli side of the armistice line, and race laws awaiting them even if they did. Apartheid in Israel for its non-Jewish population, and we would have not only accepted the legitimacy of the 1947 UN partition that was shoved through under US pressure, but at the same time accepted Israel's right alone to disregard it. Contrary to the term 1967 borders, the armistice line was explicitly not a border, but a ceasefire line and nothing more, orphaning more than half of the land the UN had given to the Palestinians onto the Israeli side of it. Israel was supposed to return to its actual borders or some other mutually agreed solution, but simply refused. Now, if we're told that it's too late to undo this, well, yes, that was the whole idea. It's been the tactic with everything Israel has done. I'm not in favor of using the word occupation, but if we do use it, it must refer not just to territory, but also to the occupation of people by ethnicity, and thus geographically to the entire land from river to sea. Apartheid was imposed on Palestine by the British on behalf of the Zionist settlers over a century ago and has remained the state of the land since. Okay, then if ending the occupation won't bring justice, what will? The cure has always been right in front of our eyes. One secular, democratic state. Everyone there now who wants to remain becomes an equal citizen in a shared society. And equality means, by definition, that every refugee has the absolute, individual, unqualified right to return home. Yet this idea of simple equality, which we in the modern West claim to venerate, suddenly becomes controversial, scandalous, even hate speech when it is applied to Israel-Palestine. Why? Why do our governments support Israel's crimes, even suppressing us on Israel's behalf, while claiming that we are a righteous nation enjoying, so we tell ourselves, a free press? How has our complicity been secured, even with Israel's ongoing crimes in plain sight for the world to see? In an attempt to answer that, I'd like to tell a quick story, a true story. 5 years ago, in response to some talks that I had given, including in nearby Amherst, some Zionist media labeled me a hate speaker, as it did to everyone who discusses this issue. In my case, it was for saying that the Zionist movement conducted a wave of terror in the 1940s to establish the Israeli state. But then came a strange twist. Two such newspapers, the Jewish Chronicle and Haaretz, now carried an astonishing news scoop. In the 1940s, the Zionist movement waged a campaign of terror to create the Israeli state. Their source? Two of the many British documents I had already used and cited in far greater detail. So, why did they publish and pretend to have discovered what they had smeared me for documenting? Reading the articles, the answer was clear. Since history could no longer be buried, history had to be co-opted, subsumed into Zionist mythology. That is to say, it had to be turned into a narrative. And so what the documents really revealed was, as the Jewish Chronicle put it, quote, a blood-soaked struggle for Israel's future. Acrobatics re-narrated Zionist pre-state terror as an unwanted burden thrust upon an Israel that did not yet exist. Through narrative, Zionism's crimes became Israel's suffering. That incident is a microcosm of Israel's great weapon, its grand narrative, without which all its weapons of steel would be impotent. Now, all nation states have their mythology, their national narrative, especially settler states like the United States. And all should be challenged, but Israel's is unique both in its nature and its power, of which Western nations repressing their own citizens on behalf of that foreign nation is but one aspect. Thus, in my view, in order to end the crimes against Palestine, it is essential that we dissect Israel's narrative and expose it naked for all to see beyond its purveyor's ability to re-narrate it. And that is where history is so important. History can clear the fog of propaganda from our eyes, pull the facade off Israel's invisible armor. This approach is, in effect, my book distilled into a simple statement of purpose. For now, I will dissect Israel's narrative into three parts. One, anti-Jewish persecution and the Holocaust. The narrative has it that Zionism and the Israeli state exist and have acted in the interest of Jewish safety and dignity. Two, the Israeli creation myth, that in 1947, the UN offered both the Palestinians and the Zionists a state. And three, messianism and Israeli ownership of Jewish identity. So let's look at the first, the idea that Zionism serves the interests of Jews. When political Zionism was founded in the late 19th century, its promise to Jews of a place away from their tormentors where they could start anew obviously appealed to many Jews suffering persecution and pogroms, and they are blameless. But for Zionism's architects and leaders, the equation was reversed. Instead of Zionism serving the well-being of Jews, Jewish vulnerability served as fodder for Zionism. The historical record makes clear that the actual goal of the Zionist movement, its driving force, was not Jewish safety and dignity, but rather the Zionist state itself at the expense of Jewish safety and dignity. Anti-Jewish bigotry and violence were and remain its fuel, its reason to exist that it must forever reinvent. And this is why Israel's defenders smear anti-racists as anti-Semitic while embracing true anti-Jewish bigots and even neo-fascists. In its early years, few Jews were interested in Zionism, and many correctly dismissed it as the latest version of anti-Semitism. But Zionism imposed itself upon Jews through years of intimidation and violence. The racial nationalist settler state being its actual goal, Zionism's great altar was the construct that Jews, because they are Jews, must go to Palestine and nowhere else. During the terrible years of the late 1930s through to the end of the Second World War, Zionist leaders fought against safe haven for Jews unless that safe haven was in Palestine. It was not simply a matter of not pursuing safe haven anywhere in safe countries, which already would have been pretty damning, but actively and even violently blocking it. And so Zionism failed European Jewry during its most desperate hour. Even after Kristallnacht heralded the beginning of the Holocaust, Zionists, and Ben-Gurion specifically, opposed safe haven for Jews unless it was in Palestine. In the late 1940, the Jewish Agency, the embryonic Israeli government, blew up the immigrant ship Patria while it was docked off the Palestinian shore, killing an estimated 267 people, most of them Jewish refugees who had just fled the war in Europe, and injuring 172. The ship was bringing the refugees to safe haven in Mauritius. But in order to make them become settlers in Palestine, the Jewish Agency bombed the vessel so that it could go nowhere, indifferent to how many it might kill in the attempt. Now, I've cited this incident because it is an extraordinary example of narrative. To cover its mass murder and turn it to its advantage, the Jewish Agency spread the lie that the refugees themselves blew up the ship. A mass suicide, because the refugees were such devoted Zionists that they would rather die rather than not go to Palestine immediately. This narrative, this lie, was spread so successfully that it spawned a whole genre of plays and other works reenacting this alleged self-sacrifice for the Zionist cause. As Haganah member and future Israeli politician Eliezer Livna would later concede, quote, "The rescue of Jews was not an aim in itself, but only a means. The World Zionist Organization had a Palestine Rescue Committee in name, but it was against rescue for its own sake and insisted that nothing be spared from settlement building." Now, as damning as all this sounds, it was actually much worse, because when other people tried to bring Jews to safety, the Zionists stopped them. If Jews started finding safety and dignity elsewhere, it would lay bare Zionism's great lie, its reason to exist. I'll cite one particularly clear example from late 1942, during the height of the Holocaust, involving the efforts of Solomon Schoenfeld, a British rabbi who had been a primary figure in the Kinder transport that had saved many Jewish children on the eve of the war, and that Ben-Gurion, by the way, opposed. Schoenfeld worked to get the British government to arrange safe passage for Jews who were in Axis territory. I will quote from him. "In view of the massacres and starvation of Jews and others, interestingly, in enemy and enemy-held territories, he gathered support for a motion for the UK, quote, to declare its readiness to find temporary refuge in its own territories or in territories under its control for endangered persons." Now, this, of course, was precisely what the world needed, and inertia for his project grew quickly. By early 1943, Schoenfeld had 177 British MPs ready to support the measure, in addition to archbishops, bishops, peers, and the Episcopate of England and Wales. And so, with passage of the rescue effort in sight, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, a Zionist organization, assisted from the United States by Stephen Wise, president of the World Jewish Congress, a Zionist organization, intervened and sabotaged it. Now, Wise himself had just held a press conference days earlier in the U.S. Capitol to spread the alarm that the Nazis planned the extermination of European Jews. They all knew about the death camps, but the Zionists sabotaged the rescue project because the fraud of Zionism would have been laid bare for all to see. Its narrative evaporated. Schoenfeld's group tried everything to save the rescue effort, but was admonished, quote, in no uncertain terms, that they, the Board of Deputies, wise the Zionist establishment, would do whatever was necessary to squash government support for the rescue. The final tragedy was that in the end, the Zionists created what appeared as an internecine battle among Jews, questioning the very seriousness and urgency of the horror in Europe. Fact: the Zionists knowingly sent Jews to their deaths rather than have them live, but contradict the great Zionist narrative. In 1944, U.S. President Roosevelt and his friend Morris Ernst, who would be among the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, arranged for safe haven and new homes for 500,000 DPs, displaced people from the war, more than half of these to be resettled in the United States and Britain. Again, once the plan was headed for success, United States Zionists sabotaged it and accused Ernst of being a, quote, traitor because Ernst was Jewish. Jewish survivors of the war were particular victims. The Jewish Agency got the Allies to segregate Jewish survivors from all others into Zionist camps and then subjected them, emotionally vulnerable after having just survived the unthinkable, to what can only be described as brainwashing, literally terrorizing them into the Zionist playbook. This was so extreme that when a joint U.S.-UK committee visited the camps and asked if they might like to resettle in the United States, which had always been the favorite destination, they responded in utter terror, saying that the U.S. was so unsafe that they would commit mass suicide if forced to go to the United States. Many Jewish children whose parents had perished were being raised in adoptive European families. And so in early 1946, the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of the Palestine settlements, Rabbi Herzog, ran a kidnapping operation in Europe, forcing the children from their families, making them orphans for a second time, to ship them to Palestine as human fodder. It's important to point out that Herzog's fiercest opposition came consistently from local Jewish leaders who had the children's interests in mind rather than the interests of Zionism. But Herzog used political force to circumvent them. The kidnappings were rationalized by others at the time on the grounds that as terrible as it was to tear the children away from their families, it was understandable that Herzog would want them to be in Jewish families rather than Christian families. Now, think what you want of this in theory, but it too was a lie, because Herzog wanted to rip Jewish orphans from their Jewish adoptive families in England to ship them to Palestine as well. Zionism was over everything. Jews were its sacrifices. Jews and Jewish suffering were and remain today Zionism's addiction, its reason to exist. These are snapshots, but they are representative snapshots. That the Israeli narrative presents Israel and the Zionist movement as the torchbearer of the moral weight of European anti-Jewish persecution and the Holocaust is an obscenity. They are the cynical exploitation of the memory of Hitler's victims, all the more so in that Israel invokes their memory to help it carry on the very same crime of racial nationalism. Zionism has imposed itself with the tactics of a cult, so today the disconnect between the obvious reality and Zionism's enforced narrative has created a psychosis among its followers, who want to feel they are good, fair-minded people, while at the same time believing that Zionism is inextricably part of who they are. Now, let's take a look at the Israeli creation myth. We all know it. When in November 1947, the United Nations proposed partitioning Palestine into two states, General Assembly Resolution 181, Israel's founders embraced the offer with gratitude, whereas the Palestinians scoffed at it. The result of this Palestinian intransigence, in the words of the Zionist spin doctors at the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, known as CAMERA, the, quote, fundamental fact is that had the Palestinians accepted partition, there would have been a Palestinian state since 1948, and there would not have been a single Palestinian refugee. Now, let's overlook the rather odd logic of this claim and just ask, is it correct that Ben-Gurion and the Jewish Agency agreed to partition? Well, if we mean the theater of it, yes, within the walls of the UN, they pretended to go along with it. But it was a lie. Everyone involved knew it was a lie. In truth, they were more fanatically opposed to it than the Palestinians were, and had been preparing for years to defeat it militarily. Their alleged acceptance of it was part of their tactic to defeat it. The entire Zionist movement, from the official Jewish agency to the acknowledged terror gangs, never had any intention of honoring any agreement that gave them less than all of Palestine at a minimum. They feigned acceptance of partition because it handed them the single weapon powerful enough to defeat partition, statehood. Statehood was the key to everything. Now, this is not my interpretation. It is their own singular, repeatedly stated plans. While the tactic played out in context of partition, the core idea that recognized statehood in any part of Palestine was the ticket to the rest was already on the mind of Chaim Weizmann by 1934, 3 years before the Peel Commission made the first formal proposal for partition. Weizmann, who would become Israel's first president, discussed it with Benito Mussolini that year. He expressed it this way in his meeting with the fascist dictator. Quote, in my view, the state, even if it is small, is the Archimedean fulcrum, meaning that if you put the fulcrum in the right place on a lever, you can lift anything. When partition was formally proposed by the Peel Commission in 1937, Ben-Gurion as well envisioned accepting the idea in order to get a state, and then using statehood to conquer the rest by force and, like Weizmann, explicitly ethnically cleansing all of it. In his formal plans for Palestine, written a few years later, Ben-Gurion even predicts what would be the 1947 dance at the UN. It would be, Ben-Gurion's quote now, an irreparable mistake, he wrote, to suggest partition, but rather that statehood should be extracted from the offer of partition, the rest of the land then taken by force into Transjordan if possible, and cleansed of non-Jews. This singular goal was reaffirmed at a key meeting of Zionist leaders held in London in 1941. With the notable exception of the non-Zionist industrialist Robert Whaley Cohen, who bluntly accused the Zionists of following Nazi ideology, everyone else was in agreement. And the plan grew only more entrenched throughout the years that followed and was fully matched, indeed, before, during, and immediately after the Jewish Agency pretended to agree to partition within UN walls in 1947. Among the ways they prepared was by building extensive outposts and settlements specifically on the land they expected to fall on the Palestinian side of any partition, by conducting extensive, meticulous surveillance of Palestinian villages for the express purpose of knowing how best to depopulate and destroy them when the time came, and by corrupting U.S. politicians to their cause. There was, however, one thing that could go wrong, and that was if the U.N. were simply to propose a state of all the people, whether a true single state or a binational state. That would make their job vastly more difficult. And indeed, when in the summer of 1947, UNSCOP, the UN committee tasked with proposing a solution to the Palestine problem, when they presented their recommendation, there were two proposals, partition or a binational single state. Presented with both options, why was a state of all its people the loser? The obvious answer based on history is actually stated outright in British cabinet papers at the time. The answer is fear of Zionist terrorism. The UN selected partition because they knew that if they didn't, the Zionists would have responded with, quote, an intensification of Jewish terrorism. That is, an intensification of Zionist terror beyond that which had already brought Palestine to its knees. And more to the point for the decision makers, was now increasingly threatening Europe. Now, having selected partition in principle, the UN now had to map this partition. So, how to explain that their partition gave more than half of the land to the Zionists, who, despite the massive influx of settlers, were still a minority? Why did they give such a disproportionately large chunk of Palestine to the Zionists? Well, the answer lays to rest any lingering question that the UN knew that Israel would ignore partition. Again, quoting the British, the desire for expansion might develop earlier if the Jewish state occupied a smaller area and would be felt more strongly if the Jews were dissatisfied with the frontiers. So, the UN hoped simply to delay, not prevent, but just delay Israel's first expansionist war by giving them so much up front. The partition line, in effect, was mapped to include the theoretical fruits of Israel's first expansionist war, saving the UN from the embarrassment of it coming so soon. But this appeasement, of course, failed because Israel began its first expansionist war beyond partition immediately. And note that it is implicit throughout this that the UN also assumed that its Security Council would do nothing to stop Israel. And indeed, the UN did nothing. Within days of the passing of partition, Ben-Gurion raced to start yet more settlements on land on the Palestinian side, moved government-to-be institutions to Jerusalem, and the mayor of Tel Aviv publicly boasted that his city would never be the new state's capital, but rather that it would be Jerusalem. All of this in direct violation of the partition to which, the narrative has it, the Jewish agency had just agreed. A scant 2 weeks after Resolution 181, the British already confirmed outright what they had predicted a year earlier, that the state promised to the Palestinians would never be. And even before the new year struck, the Zionists had already begun commandeering and ethnically cleansing all-important Jaffa, which partition had given to the Palestinians. And by the time Israel self-declared statehood in mid-May of 1948, which was before the Arab resistance, it had seized and ethnically cleansed much of the land it had supposedly agreed would go to Palestine. Resolution 181, partition, was a scam. Everyone involved with it knew that it was a scam, and above all, the Palestinians knew it was a scam. In the world as it is, statehood is our measure of all things. From the mantle of statehood, the Zionists' terrorism became Israeli military operations, whereas for the Palestinians denied the podium of statehood, their self-defense was now terrorism. For the British, the UN ruse was a way to extricate themselves from the catastrophe they had nurtured and leave the Palestinians to suffer the result. And now, finally, let's look at the very question of the Israeli state versus Jews. If I ask, what is Israel? I think most people would repeat what the state itself says it is and how news reports refer to it. It is the Jewish state. Now, we accept this term with little thought. But even on the obvious level, the term already creates a magic shield around Israel by hijacking Jewish identity. How often have I heard, "Why are you always criticizing the Jewish state?" But it goes far beyond that. The Jewish state is a stealth term that creates a messianic gateway to the public mind. There is an entire world of narrative hidden within these three words, the most powerful of which is the article, the. Israel does not claim to be merely a Jewish state in the sense of countries that have a national religion. Indeed, to quote Ben-Gurion, Israel has nothing to do with Judaism, but rather with, Ben-Gurion's words, being a Jew, and nor with being an Israeli Jew, but the ethnicity itself. According to Israel's construct, it is the state of all Jews, free of national borders, and indeed free of individual Jewish consent on the matter. And it is for this reason that Israel does not allow Israeli nationality for Jews. The nationality of Jewish citizens of Israel is, by Israeli law, Jewish. This nation-state adaptation of tribalism, in which the state is part of the DNA of an ethnic identity, is the internal workings of its weapon of silencing critics through the smear of anti-Semitism, and is unknown in the modern world, with two exceptions, Israel and common bigots. To explain, everyday racists blame individuals by virtue of perceived oneness with some ethnicity or nationality or type. And so, for example, during the spread of COVID-19, Chinese-looking people were attacked because the virus came from China. They, the Chinese, caused COVID. This is classic ignorant bigotry, and we all condemn it. Israel does precisely this to Jews, but turns it around in order to hold Jewish identity ransom to insulate its crimes. We would say, Israel did XYZ. A bigot would say, the Jews did XYZ. But that bigot is now the Israeli state and its cheerleaders, who have made state and ethnicity synonymous in order to repackage criticism of the state as anti-Semitic. Other states deflect criticism of their crimes by hiding behind the flag, accusing dissenting citizens of being unpatriotic to the state. Israel instead hides behind the ethnicity free of borders, accusing dissenting voices anywhere of being traitorous to the ethnicity. The brand name Israel and the Hebrew language are also held hostage by the Zionist narrative. For anyone from the larger Western tradition, and I include secular people, the name Israel exists apart from all other place names. Its very sound transcends the realm of the profane and touches a nerve deep within our collective subconscious. It is a place rooted in Genesis itself, and Israel, the modern nation state, openly exploits this to position itself as that place and the land's ancient artifacts as the nation state's artifacts and its settlers as that biblical land's people. And as laughable as this may and should sound, its power is very real. For us, one easy way to partially mitigate this power is always to use the term the Israeli state, never just Israel, unless you mean the place in the Bible. The Zionist use of Hebrew as the vernacular operates in tandem. Our association with that venerable ancient language is not just geographic, it is also temporal. It, too, is an artifact serving to place the Israeli state in a protected part of our collective psyche. Hebrew is exploited to tell our subconscious that the settler, fresh off the plane, moving into a West Bank outpost on ethnically cleansed land, is a native who has been there for 3,000 years. As an illustration of how quickly and how powerfully Zionism marketed the brand name Israel, and its kidnapping of Jewish identity in order to wield the smear of anti-Semitism to defend its crimes, let's go back to 1948-1949. I turn to none other than Winston Churchill. When, after the supposed ceasefire at the end of 1948, Israel was trying to seize yet more territory in Gaza and the Sinai, it continually blocked UN observers from the area who wanted to see what was going on. And so in early January, Britain sent small aircraft, they were Spitfires and Tempests, from Egypt to investigate. Israel shot down 5 British aircraft over non-Israeli territory, killing 2 British pilots. So, what was Churchill's reaction? In a personal minute, not declassified until 2013, Churchill defends Israel and repeatedly smears Ernest Bevin, who had been foreign secretary, as anti-Semitic for condemning the Israeli attacks. In the document, Churchill specifically equates the then 7.5-month-old Israeli state with the biblical realm and refers to the Israeli aircraft that shot down 5 of their planes and killed 2 of their pilots as Israelite airplanes. The irony does not end there. In the same letter, Churchill worries about, quote, the powerful and possibly decisive Jewish vote, especially in New York. But let's go straight to the crux of this construct of the Jewish state. This self-identity requires that Israel preserve what it considers to be blood purity by way of laws forbidding intermarriage between someone who the state considers to be Jewish with someone whom, according to the state, is not Jewish, and that this select lineage remain the majority, and that all others are legally lesser human beings. Now, herein lies Israel's conundrum. Such race laws and the concept of blood purity should shock us, should revolt us. Yet Israel has no choice, because without these race laws, Israel, by its own self-definition as the Jewish state, a definition we have embraced, would cease to exist. If we are going to accept this idea of such a state, can we blame Israel for its ethnic cleansings of 1948 and 1967, or its backburner ethnic cleansing that has been ongoing all these years through to this moment? No. Can we blame Israel for keeping 6 million human beings in camps because they're not Jewish? No. Can we blame Israel for keeping non-Jews river to sea under apartheid and killing any non-Jewish teenagers showing signs of leadership against their oppression? No. Either we agree that this is not only acceptable, but indeed something to be massively funded, massively defended, and that our own freedoms should be curtailed in its behalf, or we have to say that the Zionist state, as such, must end. The idea of a racially predicated state is not a condition of Israel that can be legislated away with tweaks to the system. It is the very premise of the state itself. Now, we are often challenged about Israel's right to exist. This is nonsense. No state has the intrinsic right to exist. People have the intrinsic right to exist. States are social, political, economic, legal structures invented by people to serve them and that exist at their pleasure. Israel does not exist with the consent of the vast majority of the people whose lives it controls. And to be sure, Israel is not the only such state. Everyone there now, everyone, river to sea, plus all the refugees, they have the intrinsic right to exist on that land as equals. No one should be frightened by this. South Africa is a different state than it was 50 years ago. It is not a different people. No one got hurt when the old South Africa was replaced with a state of all its people. Understandably, in the fight for justice in Palestine, we tend to focus on Israel's actions. We should, of course, but it's not enough. We need also to expose the actual problem, a state based on Zionism. Until we do that, we will always be just condemning Israel's crimes. When we fought against apartheid in South Africa, we didn't just condemn the state's violence, we opposed the race state itself. As citizens of the United States or other complicit nations, opposing Zionism's reign of terror in Palestine is not optional, not merely a matter of common humanity. We must oppose it because our countries are it. The terror continues in our name, with our money, our power, our weapons, and our moral currency. And we must oppose it because we, too, are under a Zionist reign of terror, as our political and civil liberties are corrupted on Israel's behalf. But in stark contrast to the Palestinians, we've agreed to this. We've agreed to subject ourselves to Israel's terror. Israel cannot force us to make loyalty oaths to it in order to live freely in the United States. We are to blame for obeying. Decades of intermittent negotiations, above all Oslo, have been a charade. Indeed, the very idea of negotiations to stop a crime is a charade. We must demand that our elected leaders instead treat the so-called conflict not just as the crime that it is, but indeed as their crime, our crime. Thank you.
That was Tom Suarez speaking before the Media Education Foundation in Northampton, Massachusetts. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on KKRN.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.